Well, thank you, Henrik. Henrik introduced the problem that I'm talking about here. This is a problem, okay? And we assume that the fluid, again, is incompressible and inviscid, and I am assuming no surface tension. So it's your classical gravity wave. And the notation, this is the notation, it's the same as the notation that Henrik mentioned. And so the free surface is eta. The work I'm talking about here is all joint with Adrian Constantine. Okay. So maybe I don't have to say this, but I have heard more than once that vorticity is not important in water waves. I've heard that, so I thought I might just say, and maybe it's not necessary. We've heard a lot about vorticity at this conference already, but I think it's worthwhile saying that vorticity does occur a lot in gravity waterways, so you can have wind and shear current and so on. Okay? Okay. Now, what I'm talking about, I'm going to be, as you heard, I will be talking about constructing exact periodic traveling water waves. For irrotational waves, this is not a trivial problem already. The first actual exact construction, mathematical constructions, were by Nekrasov and Levi-Civita and Struik in the 1920s. These were small amplitude waves. And then large amplitude waves were then constructed by Krasovsky, Kedia, Norbury, Tolland, Amick, McLeod, and I think I left out Frankel, maybe, in the 1960s and 70s. When you have vorticity, there was always Gerstner's wave. And that sat there since there's actually an 1802 paper, and then it was reprinted in 1809, so it's 200 years old. And everyone knows about Gerstner's wave, you just heard about it. By the method of the same method as those people in the 1920s, Dubois-Jacotin constructed small amplitude waves. But apparently no one constructed large amplitude waves until now. And actually, you see funny things in the literature, like saying that vorticity must destroy any regular periodic wave. Shear, in other words, would destroy a regular periodic wave, but that's actually not true because you have lots of them. So that's the point that I want to make here, is that there are many, many waves, exact waves, of the full nonlinear problem with general vorticity and even with large amplitude. Okay, so I think probably I'll just put this quickly on the board. It's the same notation as you just saw in the last lecture. I'm going to use UV without an arrow for the components of velocity. And here are the Euler equations, and here are the standard boundary conditions. Everything's standard, and it's 2D flow, so vorticity is just a scalar. Okay. And as you already heard, the stream function and the stream function psi and the relative stream function, I put the C in there. Oh, I have a pointer. Yeah, so I have a C in there. So I move to a moving frame, and it becomes a problem with no time in it at all, and then you just have this elliptic equation in green here. And this is what Henrik called capital M. I call it P naught. It's the relative mass flux. It's just you take a vertical slice and you look at how much is flowing, the rate of things flowing horizontally. And that's a constant. That's what he called M. I call it P naught. Okay, so theorem I want to talk, the main theorem I want to talk about is the following one. It says that there are lots of these waves, lots of exact waves. So it says, given a period L, that's the wavelength, and speed C, and this relative mass flux, which I call little p naught, and an arbitrary vorticity function, gamma, which relates the stream function to the vorticity. There exists lots of these waves. Now, there's a condition, which I'll say in a moment. So there's a condition we have to assume, which I'll say in a moment. So under that condition, you have exact waves of this type, just regular waves that look like that. And there's many of them. And there's a whole connected set of those for each of those choices. And these waves are not, well, AD equals zero, that means a totally flat surface. I call it a trivial wave. And so there's actually a curve of solutions, a continuum, technically, of solutions which goes from the trivial all the way up to waves that have stagnation. Stagnation means that the horizontal velocity of some particles is the same as the speed of the surface. And the solutions I'm talking about, they're all, I don't have any overhanging waves. It's before the breaking. I can't handle the overhanging waves. So it goes up to the point where they might, this is presumably the point where they break, where you have stagnation at some point. So you have lots of these waves. Each of these things on the connected set is a solution of the problem. Now, I have to say what the condition is. The condition that we need to assume, I think the simplest way to say, look at example 3 without going into all that detail. Example 3. Any vorticity function at all, that's the relationship between vorticity and stream function, and if this relative mass flux is small enough, smaller than some number, then it's satisfied. I think that's the simplest thing to say. I can go into more detail. You can have any irrotational flow at all without a condition of smallness, or you can have more technical conditions, which I think I'll omit for this audience, but there's more specific conditions which I could state. And as I'm still, so I, just to repeat what Henrik said quickly again, we make a transformation of variables, and it's the same notation he used, where I use the stream function as one variable that transforms, see, it's periodic with some period. I'm going to choose the period to be 2 pi, just for simplicity. And so I have this domain between two periods. That's the actual water, and it transforms that domain D into R, which is fixed rectangle. And what happens when I make that transformation and I introduce this variable, which is the height. And then in that, so H is this height variable. And then you have the problem in red here, which is the same one you saw in the last talk. So here's the problem. It becomes a problem. It's a PDE, it's a quasi-linear PDE inside the fluid in that rectangle. We have a finite bottom here, so the bottom is simple boundary condition. On the top, you have a pretty nonlinear boundary condition right here. These are squares, and here's another H. And as long as HP, the HDP, which is this, is positive, it's an elliptic PDE. Being positive means that the horizontal speed is less than C, which is exactly the condition we've been talking about. So we have a problem which is elliptic, but as U goes to C, it becomes parabolic. And so that problem, in order to show that there are these waves, we have to solve that problem. Now, there are trivial waves. Trivial waves are one, if you look, recall the notation we're using, we change the name of x, the horizontal variable, to q. Q is just horizontal variable. So if you have a trivial flow, nothing depends on q. And then this becomes very simple, very, very simple. If you have a trivial flow, anything with a q derivative drops out. So only you have you have HPP, and this drops out, and this drops out, and then you have this, so you have simple ODE. You can solve that ODE. These are the trivial waves. And you have a curve of trivial waves. So it's going to look like this. The curve of trivial waves looks... So let me, again, write that down. There's also a parameter here, Q. Q is a parameter which is, you could think of as the speed of the crest, not related to the speed of the crest, or sort of the energy. Specifically, it's a constant E, which is basically the energy minus the atmospheric pressure plus GD. But that parameter appears in this problem as a free parameter. It can be anything. And we use that as a bifurcation parameter and use bifurcation theory. And so what you're going to get is, so Q is a free parameter, and you have the trivial flows. And the trivial flows are just depend on one parameter. So I draw a bifurcation picture. Here's the parameter. Here's the bifurcation parameter. And here's function space, infinite dimensional. So this is a curve of trivial flow, and it's actually 2 to 1 here. And what we're looking for to start with are small amplitude waves which bifurcate from some point along the trivial curve. That's what we're looking for. And to do that, you look for a failure of the implicit function theorem at that point. And that's looking at that's the same as looking at a certain linearized problem. So that linearized problem is actually quite simple, but not totally standard. It's a linear problem, and M is the unknown here, and it's some linear equation. M is a function of P and Q, and here's this capital H is the trivial solution. Capital H depends on a parameter, which here I'm calling lambda. Lambda is the parameter along that blue curve. Lambda is here, and lambda is in here, and lambda is in here, so it appears in funny places. It's not your standard eigenvalue problem, but it is a linear problem with a parameter in it, and we can show that there's a place where you have a simple eigenvalue. Eigenvalue now means lambda. It's not really eigenvalue in the generalized sense. So we can apply standard bifurcation from simple eigenvalue theory, which is due in its best form, at least, to Crandall and Rabinowitz a long time ago, 1971. And you get this curve automatically. You get actually a curve of small amplitude solutions. This is not the way they did it in the 1920s. Now, now that I've shown you how it, the beginning of the bifurcation curve, I'd like to digress in the discussion of the construction to talk about a variational formulation. So the first thing I want to say is that, so I just talked about H of QP. That's the reformulated problem. And in fact, there's a Lagrangian, an action. There is an action which I write entirely in terms of the newly formulated problem. I write it as a function of H. There's a functional, in other words, a functional so that the Euler-Lagrange equations exactly are the solutions of that steady state problem. I never saw that before, but it's not actually very difficult. And the more interesting thing is the following. That now we look at whether in some, ask for the following question. Look at the weakest, what's the weakest way in which we can ask the question of stability of these waves? You should have the Benjamin fear in stability. When you have sideband perturbations, you're going to have the Benjamin fear in stability. On the other hand, of course, for a lot of shallow water approximations, you have a lot of stability. You can't be more stable than KdV. So they should, let's look at this exact, these exact solutions and at least ask the question whether there's some kind of stability remaining in this problem. So in this formulation, the simplest way to, the most elementary way to say that is just look for this, take this Lagrangian and just, is H a local minimum? Are these solutions local minima of that Lagrangian at all? If they're local minima, that's some very weak statement about stability. Okay. So we can show the following. You look along first along that trivial curve. That's the same curve I had before, the trivial curve. Ask whether those trivial ones are stable in this extremely weak sense. So the answer is they're in this sense. Stable, remember, is this very, very weak sense. So they're stable exactly until you come to that bifurcation point, and on that part of the curve, they're unstable in this particular sense. Not only that, we can show that under some conditions, named at least if gamma is sufficiently small, that's the vorticity function, and the depth, and it's shallow water in the sense that the depth divided by the wavelength is sufficiently small, that you also have stability, that the stability transfers from here onto this curve. Actually, it may be true without these conditions, but we just discovered this a month ago, less than a month ago. So, I think to understand what's going on here, I think I should emphasize the following. The speed of this wave has disappeared from the problem in the transformations. The speed is arbitrary. Think of the speed as fixed. The wavelength is fixed. This mass flux, which Hendrik called M, I call P dot, is fixed. And this Q in this thing, which is this basically the energy of the wave, is fixed. So the perturbation is restricted. And then we get this weak stability result. I also want to emphasize that the time has disappeared. I don't, at least not yet, so far I don't know how to say anything about the actual temporal behavior of the problem. The Lagrangian is actually not that complicated. That's the Lagrangian written in terms of these variables that we use. These are the Dubray-Jacotin variables. And maybe it might be interesting. In our calculations, we get the condition of the shallowness condition, at least in the case of irrotational flow, is this, approximately. I've never seen anything like this for irrotational flow, in fact. I hope, the beginning of something more extensive. Now, let me go back to the... This one again? That's a Lagrangian. That's really... It's just a transformation of the Lagrangian that you might write down naturally, except I have... This thing is the vorticities in here, in this term. Q is a constant. It's this bifurcation. So Q is this constant, which is, I think, to oversimplify, it's the energy of the thing, the total energy. It's a constant. It's an energy for the steady state wave. Well, it's a traveling, but I got in a moving frame, it's steady state. It's just a constant. These streamlines are not closed. These streamlines are not going to be closed. Yeah, right, yes. I think so. Yeah, right. So I keep that on the board. So what I want to do is continue this. These are the trivial ones. And then this is the bifurcation curve. And so far we've just done bifurcation from a simple eigenvalue. So there's a little local curve here. I want to extend that to the big curves to large amplitude solutions. These are small amplitude. large amplitude solutions, non-trivial. So to do that, I use the extension of bifurcation theory, which is called global bifurcation theory, which is basically uses topological degree arguments. So the result says is you have a curve of solutions, and now you want to continue that curve. Where can that curve end? You want to show that it can only end in certain ways. So in the first step here, we show it can only end. This continuum, it just started as a curve of solutions. That curve can only end in the following three ways. Either it's unbounded in function space, or the parameter Q is the bifurcation parameter, is unbounded. Or it goes back to trivial. This curve goes back to the trivial curve. Or it meets, degenerates, which means that this inequality, which was important, which was basic to what we're talking about, becomes equal, or this becomes equal. This means that HP to go to zero means the equation loses ellipticity, and for this to go to become inequality with delta equals zero means that the boundary condition becomes a non-elliptic boundary condition. And, so we use basically Le Raye outer degree, but we need to use a more particular form due to Kielhofer, Healy, and Simpson, recently used for elasticity theory. And the bifurcation aspects of these and a lot of the basic idea of what we're talking about here is due to Rabinowitz, the Rabinowitz global bifurcation theory. So I think I'm going to skip that proof of that. I'll just talk about it. Okay. So in this theorem, there were several alternatives. One was that you can go back to the trivial curve, and if you make careful use of the maximum principle. Quite careful use of the maximum principle, we can show that this does not come back to the trivial curve. So what's involved in that is the following, is that in the original problem, you have, in the picture, this rectangle is given in this picture here, and you have a crest and a trough, and from the crest to the trough, it's going to be monotone. These waves are going to be standard waves, they're going to monotone from crest to trough. And that monotonicity can be expressed in terms of the variables we're talking about. H is basically the vertical variable, Q is the horizontal variable, so dH dQ is negative. So that's how we use the maximum principle. That's the basic thing. And we have a rectangle, and we have to be careful about the sides and the corners. At the sides, we use the Hopf form of the maximum principle. The corners, we use the Serrin principle. Okay, that's the basic idea. So we show that this can't happen because this HQ, these strict inequalities can only happen at one point on the trivial curve and not another one. These eigenvalues are unique. So we exclude that possibility. And then we use some quite sophisticated... 2-3 minutes. Good. That's perfect. Quite sophisticated estimates of Lieberman and Schrödinger, which are like super forms of the Schauder estimates, in order to reduce the space in which we were working was the space of very, very smooth functions, three times differentiable. We can reduce that a lot. Finally, at the end, and then we get also some additional inequalities, lower bound on the pressure inside the fluid and a lower bound on the horizontal speed of the crest. These are the lemmas at the bottom here. Okay, when we do that, we can exclude various possibilities. The only thing that's left at the end of doing all this, we can exclude anything. This and this are the only two things that are left as possibilities. Here are all the possibilities from the general theorem. These are all that's left. And then we can say that, then we can prove that if this happens, then also this happens. So at the end, we have super view goes to C. That's stagnation. So as you go along this curve, way up on the far ends of the curve, you can only have stagnation. And that's how that's the outline of how we go about doing this. And so things that we're now working on in this direction are, on the one hand, this weak stability result, which we have just recently figured out, and we want to carry that further. We've also Well, I can leave that on. You can see there are other parts, but I'm looking at this right here. We're looking at the limiting wave as you go towards stagnation. We don't actually have a limiting wave yet, anyway. We'd like to go to overhanging waves, which is, at the moment, we don't know how to do. So this continuum should continue to overhanging waves. And then my student, Vera Hoare, who's here somewhere, over here, she has just completed a paper of doing essentially the analog of what we have for the case of infinite depth. So Gerstner's wave was actually infinite depth. And so Vera's theorem actually says that there are lots of solutions with infinite depth, while our theorem says there are lots of solutions of finite depth, which are exact periodic solutions. Okay, thank you.